afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Other Minds and Hands. This is episode number 65, and today Maggie and I are going to be returning to our opening series and continuing the suggestions that we got from our viewers, and we're continuing our adaptation of children's literature, kind of a little mini sequence that we're doing here. We've been talking about Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass for the last, the Alice in Wonderland movies, which covered both of the books, for the last couple weeks. And today we're going to shift to discussing Winnie the Pooh and looking at openings, again, focusing on the openings and thinking about the ways in which this book has been adapted. But first, actually, before we jump into Winnie the Pooh, before we get back to the Hundred Acre Wood, we want to do a little bit of current events discussion. So the first thing we wanted to say is that both of us saw Dune 2 this past weekend, and
it almost derailed tonight completely.
Yeah, it was close.
We're like, we have to talk about this.
Whew.
Yeah. We didn't talk to each other beforehand. Corey was just messaging me about tonight, about Winnie the Pooh, and was like, by the way, I saw Dune. I was like, me too.
Yeah. So especially having just talked about it recently, having talked about the first one, doing the openings there. Of course, needless to say, Maggie, I was like hyper-focused on the opening of the second film, thinking about all the stuff that we discussed with the opening and the way that they were, and thinking also of the way that they were like, paying off in different ways the opening of the first one through this.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a lot to talk about, but we decided we would stay on schedule and then also give you guys opportunities, you know, people who haven't seen it yet, another week to see it before we discuss it. But we definitely wanted it. So we're planning to, the plan is to discuss Dune 2 next week. And think about that adaptation, which, so like the main spoiler, it's really good. Like it's very, very good.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't quite have words for it yet. I'll work on it by next week, but yeah. Phil, dare we ask your overall verdict? Just
phenomenal.
Gobsmacked was the word I kept saying. 'Cause my husband and I have to see it separately because of 2-year-old. And I saw it first, and the message back, he was like, well, and I do not share my opinions. I hate reading reviews before I watch them. And I was like, I'm quite pleased. I am gobsmacked at many moments, and I need the sound in my ears always.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. The soundtrack was incredible.
And the sound mixing is just how it was used as like a narrative device. And
Oh, man. Yeah,
and Hooten worm riding could be so damn cool.
It was awesome. Anyway, so good. So there's a lot to talk about there, and I'm really excited because it was another one of those just delightful moments. I've been having a lot of these now when I watch adaptations. Maggie, I can tell how much I've been learning from our discussions because it's such a different experience. There were several things that I was like just really quickly, like things that I was noticing were different. And I was like, but I see what they're doing. You know, like, so there were a couple, like when I was discussing with my family afterwards, we're like, so there are changes that they made, which are like real functional changes to the story. Like they chose to take the story in a different way or chose to cut this thing out or something like that. But then there are these other changes, which I think are pretty clearly changes that they made in order to like, stay the same, like changes that they made in order to like effectively convey in film a thing that I think the book was conveying, but in a very different way. So they had to change it in order to convey it through the film medium instead of the
make it work.
It was awesome. There's so much to talk about there. A really fascinating example of a very, very success. But this is us not talking about it. So we'll come back next week and we'll discuss it more next week. But
I'm really glad to hear that, though. I feel like it's such a gift you can give yourself to just try to enjoy an adaptation. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you have to love it. Like, you don't have to love every decision made. But isn't it nice when you give yourself the opportunity to have a nice afternoon instead of one that makes you irate?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But
so we are going to talk about Dune.
Yeah, we'll talk about Dune next week. We'll talk about Dune next. So much to say. So
and maybe the following week. We'll see.
Exactly. But
there's a piece of news too.
But what? Oh yeah. So the Rings of Power news. So the big news from Amazon this past week was that the showrunners, JD and Patrick, have been extended, right? Their contract has been extended officially through season two. So that was just kind of an interesting piece of news. It was particularly
season two, or was it three?
I think it was through three.
Yeah.
Through three. So through another season after the one that's, yeah, I guess, in the can, right? And in post now. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're just picking to outline three, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, and the thing that was, the thing that I find most noteworthy about this, there are a bunch of people who are surprised by this. There were a lot of people who said, like, oh man, the Rings of Power really underperformed expectations, and you know, they're probably going to fire everybody and, you know, try to like recover it by moving in a different direction and bring in some other like famous name, you know, or whatever. I mean, we all heard lots of this sort of thing, this sort of speculation after season one ended,
and we've seen it before in other series, but that was not something that Corey and I ever thought was really on the table, just from everything that we'd heard and experienced and know about this project.
Yeah. And but what's more, I'm really glad to see that not happen. Yeah, and this is, you know, for a couple reasons. I mean, one is that in general I've always disliked that impulse, like that business impulse, like that corporate impulse, you know, to say, like, you know, that was not exactly what I expected, so fire everyone and start again. Right. Like, that's, you know, it's not uncommon. It's not even in some cases wholly unjustified. Like, it can be a justifiable approach, but it's not one I've ever loved. But more, I was hoping that we would see a little bit of patience. And I'm glad to see a little bit of patience. It's one of the things, and I know, Maggie, you and I have said this so many times, like when you are doing, as the showrunners of The Rings of Power were doing, planning a 5-year, not like we're producing a season and hoping it will be continued and that we'll get a chance to do, you know, so we're going to do, you know, a show like something like Stranger Things, right? Stranger Things is, in my mind, a really good example of a show which was put out there one season to see what people, and it turned out to be really successful, so got renewed and they continued it and have made it into a large arc story that, you know, that spans 5 seasons. But that was not the plan, you know, from the beginning. When we saw season one of that show, we were very much not seeing 20% of a story, right?
Right.
In Rings of Power, we absolutely were seeing 20% of a story. And when you stop watching a film after 20% of it and then try to judge even like whether it's going in an attractive direction or not, it can be really hard. You know, many have been the film and TV series where the first 20% was not your favorite part or didn't find its feet yet, and that kind of thing.
And it shouldn't, you know, we've talked about it a lot, but like, you know, season one of many 10 season shows is a bit rough because everybody's kind of finding their feet. And, you know, we compared Rings of Power to the Peter Jackson trilogy. And in terms of time spent, we're only in Bree. Mm-hmm. Like, that's as far as we got into the story, if you're taking 20% in. So, yeah, it's hard to measure the entirety of a thing. The reason I wasn't really surprised by this news was purely the time put into the pre-production. I mean, these guys have been developing this for 5 years, like a significant amount of time and money and resources and efforts and all that. It would be a pretty poor financial decision to nix it after one season.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's not their investment either. So maybe if season two crashes too, we'll hear some different rumblings, but I would be very surprised. I feel like they're like, nope, this is the horse that we're betting on and we got to see it through.
And the timing was interesting too. That is because season two is in the can, right? I mean, it's in post-production. So it's in, it exists, the stuff exists in some form, right? So one has to imagine, you know, if this announcement had been made a year ago, right, mm-hmm. then that would have just been a sort of a, I don't know what, like a high-end procedural, like we're committed to stay the course and see what happens, right?
Yeah.
At this point now, there's enough out there for them to see. I mean, the people making this decision have probably seen, you know, what there is to see of season two. And
I'm sure there were a lot of rough cuts put in front of decision makers' eyes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, so it does suggest that they were interested in what they saw too. Not that that necessarily influences me into thinking it's going to be awesome, because I don't know that my opinion would be the same as theirs. But still, I am certainly, you know, there were, goodness knows, you know, I've made no secret about the fact that there were a lot of things in season one I wasn't a huge fan of. But I still respect the showrunners. I see no, you know, I have not lost faith in them. And I'll be interested to see what you know, where they can go. And I think it's going to be more interesting to see. I would much rather, like, the narrative I would rather watch unfold, right, is to see what they can do to kind of, you know, continue to develop and steer this series, rather than, you know, the sort of recovery story.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think it'll be interesting to see how some of the other elements change if they do. You know, we've talked a lot about marketing. We've talked a lot about structure, you know, some of those bits and some of the wraparound behind the scenes coverage, interview elements, all that stuff. Like, we know there's so much that they could be doing that I hope they kind of tap into that a bit more and realize that there's a real thirst for that.
Yes. Yes.
But yeah, in terms of story, I'm not surprised it's these guys. I think it makes sense to stay the course with them, lean in a little bit and see what we get from it. Yeah, we have seen, I mean, we haven't, but we imagine somebody has seen most of season two. So, like, somebody proved it and been like, all right, here we go. And now you guys can start outlining three. So they're happy enough to lead into that.
Yep. Yeah.
Do we have a firm release date? We've just heard September, haven't we? But we don't.
Rumors about the end of this year. Yeah, sometime. But yeah.
That'd be interesting.
And obviously, you know, the marketing is way behind the calendar that they were at last time. I mean, it was
Super Bowl was the first trailer, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they released that first image, almost exactly a year, like at the beginning of September the year before it came out, and then the Super Bowl trailer was the first one. So, the marketing is. If it is going to be released, again, we don't know 100% for sure. If it is going to be released sometime in 2024, then the marketing calendar is significantly more compressed than last time. But who know? I know nothing about that. So, you know, who knows?
We haven't been invited to any secret gatherings yet.
Exactly.
So.
Yes. Yeah. Would emphasize, I feel like we always have to say this, Maggie, like, we don't have inside information on this. Yeah. We've not been told anything. We're not passing along anything. This is us just sort of talking about and speculating about this stuff. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
But it is starting us talking about season two. You know, like, we obviously want to look into Rings and Realms and things like that. And that's
something we have talked about.
That's a project. So that does. I mean, that takes not maybe as much planning as season two of Rings of Power, but it's not far off it.
Exactly.
For our needs.
So we'll see. We'll see what happens there. But we are definitely. We've already been talking to the Rings and Realms team, they're definitely excited to try something out. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, goals. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting. So roll on season two and three more after that.
Indeed, cool. Indeed.
So there's the big news this week, huh?
That's the news. That's the news this week. All right. So let's let's head to the 100 Acre Woods. So, Winnie the Pooh. I saw someone admitting Winnie the Pooh was still their favorite book at the age of 58, and that is totally understandable. This is a brilliant book. Certainly one of those classic examples of a book which you just appreciate more and more richly the older you get. It is a phenomenal book. When doing the one question I had about this, Maggie, doing the opening, I'm like, what counts as the opening of Winnie the Pooh exactly? Because here's what we get, right? First, we get the images. So the illustrations are important, right? And we've got the, you know, the picture of Winnie the Pooh showing up at Owl's house, right, with Eeyore's tail hanging as the knocker on the branch there. And then the cover page of Christopher Robin pulling on his boots, leaning back against Pooh, right? So there's the first thing we get are these images. This is not exactly a picture book, but the pictures, I think, are important.
Very telling. I feel like there's a really big, like, context given by some of the imagery of this. Even the cover of most of the text will have that really simple sketch of Pooh. And it just sets a certain tone that, one, it's a really simple illustration, but it's also really friendly and familiar. And I don't know, it feels comforting. Maybe that's just because we all have these connotations attached to Pooh as part of our lives. But, you know, you see that picture and you do just kind of take a bit of a breath and go, oh, okay. But if you've never encountered Pooh at all, you're starting with this really friendly child make-believe. I mean, but it looks like the treehouse that you want in your backyard, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very inviting.
Another thing that I think is really significant about the illustrations in this book is that I say this from memory of my own childhood, so it'll probably surprise few people here that I have always been a very audio-focused person. So my mom read to me all the time until I was pretty old. I mean, I was at least 10 when my mom stopped reading stories to me. So most of the books that I read, my mom read them to me first. And long after I could read and enjoyed reading myself, I preferred to have mom read to me. And I would not even always look at the book while she read. I would often do something else, like the beginnings of The Current Life I Lead, where 4 to 6 hours of every day of my life, I'm doing something like cooking or doing the dishes or something and listening to books. So I would often do something else while mom was reading to me. In other words, I have a memory of Winnie the Pooh without the illustrations, like not having looked at the illustrations. And one of the things that really struck me, I remember first seeing the illustrations after reading the story. It wasn't like the whole book, but like she'd read a couple chapters and then I looked at it and I was like, oh, he's a teddy bear. I didn't realize he was a teddy bear. I wasn't picturing a teddy bear, because there's almost nothing in the narrative cue. Like if you just read the words, there's almost nothing in the narrative cues to tell you that, in fact. But the illustrations make it very clear from before you even open the book that this is a boy and his teddy bear. But again, without the visual cues from the illustrations, if you just hear the narrative, it's not like you're going to be imagining, you know, necessarily a realistic grizzly bear or something like that. But I was imagining just like a bear. Oh, he gets called Pooh Bear and everything. Yeah, no, I mean, I knew he's a bear. It's not that. I just know he was a teddy bear. Like I was picturing a bear, a bear, like a legit bear, like the mammal.
Not like teddy bear.
No, not a stuffed animal. Like the whole conceit that these are his stuffed animals.
Okay. And that's really interesting when you're thinking about the adaptations, because, you know, both start so strongly with a immediate visual cue that this is a stuffed toy.
And part of this was for me also the fact that I didn't have very many teddy bears. Like that wasn't a thing. Like I'd stuffed animals, but not teddy bears. So like I was more likely to have like a realistic bear image. So even when the opening scene describes him dragging Winnie the Pooh down the stairs. Right. But even there, I wasn't picturing, like, I don't know why. It was undoubtedly my problem, but I didn't picture a teddy bear. And again, it's not, he doesn't exactly say. So we'll look at the opening and the introduction there. Yeah. you know, and how this is brought in and how they sort of talk about it. Phil, it is, it's a sort of shades of Calvin and Hobbes in some way. Yeah. Yeah. The, Calvin and Hobbes plays with this very interestingly, doesn't it? About the, you know, when Hobbes is just like a regular tiger, and but then at times he'll be a stuffed tiger, right? And that kind of, that question of like the vision, so thinking from a Calvin and Hobbes perspective, the comic, do you know Calvin and Hobbes, Maggie? Were you a Calvin and Hobbes person?
Yeah, I mean, I read him a little bit, but I was never like, Garfield was way more my vibe.
I was a Garfield fan as a kid too. I didn't discover Calvin and Hobbes until I was like in college, and then I just like absolutely ate up everything Calvin and Hobbes I could find, and am glad to say that my wife and I both raised our kids on both of our sons on Calvin and Hobbes throughout their childhoods. But we have like all the books. But anyway, the point is, within that, within the frame, right? Like when the story is being told, like from Calvin's perspective alone, Hobbes the tiger looks totally different. Like he looks like a regular tiger and is talking to him like another person. But then like the mom will come into the room and interact with Hobbes. And when she does, he like the picture of him changes. He becomes a stuffed animal. Right.
Right.
And in that, so in that sense, right, Bill Watterson is playing with this like the frame of Calvin's own imagination, right? So that we as readers are being brought into the point of view of Calvin's imagination in which all of this stuff is happening. And then occasionally we are shown the kind of outer frame of that, right? With Winnie the Pooh, the whole book basically takes place within that imagined frame. That's what I mean by saying I didn't like fully grasp the fact that he was a teddy bear, like a literal teddy bear, until I saw the pictures, because but the pictures do provide the frame, right? And so the pictures and the narrative kind of complement,
work together.
I mean, they give us both at once. Yeah. It's not exactly cognitive dissonance, but we do get the reminder, even in the, you know, what I would call live action shots. So like, look, again, looking at the two images I have on screen right now, the one with the famous picture of Christopher Robin pulling on his boots, leaning with his back against Pooh, right? That looks like it could very well just be an inert teddy bear, right? Totally outside the frame of Christopher Robin's imagination. Like, we don't know for sure. It's ambiguous because, like, is Pooh standing on his own? Is he not standing on his own? It's not 100% clear, right? And but certainly that image is compatible, I think, with an interpretation that says this is just Christopher. This is an inert teddy bear. This is outside, entirely outside the frame of Christopher Robin's imagination. But then the other image is the image of Pooh up the tree about to knock on Owl's door, right? And on the one hand, this is obviously completely inside the frame of Christopher's imagination, and yet Pooh looks the same. Like he's the same physically. He's the same bear. Right? He's the same teddy bear. Yes. And Nick, you're right. Part the thing that does seem to kind of reconcile the two things, like the outside and inside the imagination frames, is the fact that Christopher Robin himself doesn't imagine that Pooh is a real bear, but that he's an animated teddy bear. Like the only imagination comes in the fact that he can walk and talk on his own, right? Anyway, we're not doing that well if I haven't even figured out where the beginning of the book is. But that's the cover. So I wanted to talk about the frame and the illustrations there a little bit.
I think that's important, though, when we're talking about openings, because we've never defined with any of ours like what exactly we're starting and ending at, you know?
Yeah.
But I think this one's real interesting. You know, it's kind of like Grinch, where like you're starting with this animation element that already is feeding into the story and seeing how both the adaptations we're going to look at, which is the 1977 and the 2018 versions, seeing how they kind of play with the visuals and the idea of toy versus reality. I think it's important to point that out.
Yes. Yeah. So the second element, and of course, again, I'm going more carefully through the elements here, in part because, you know, as we've defined it in the opening series, we're interested in saying, like, in seeing how does this story orient you, right? How does the work bring you in? What kind of cues do you get to understand what kind of work it is that you're reading, right? And you know, that you're experiencing and all this kind of thing. So all of this stuff seems to be, seems to me to be importantly relevant. The next thing we get is the map of the Hundred Acre Wood.
When right? in depth, give us a good map.
Exactly. So we've got, and of course, that very, the very fact of having a map at the beginning suggests, right, this story takes place in a different world, and you need a map to that world if you're going to understand what happens, right? This is a classic, you know, fantasy literature trope, right? But yeah, it's this is a world, and it's important that you know that this is the world that you're entering into, right? And of course, one of the other things that's interesting about the map is that the map is, it presents itself as authentic, as an authentic artifact. Mm-hmm. Along the bottom are the words "drawn by me and Mr. Shepherd helped," with "helped" misspelled, as many frequent misspellings as we can see around the map. Including, of course, Hundred Acre Woods, which is spelled with a K. Yes, Phil, the map is chock full of spoilers, in fact.
Yeah.
It's almost like a table of contents. Not quite, but it's a little bit like a table of animated table of contents. The Pooh's Trap for Heffalumps, for instance, is labeled on the map, not to give too many spoilers here myself. The Bee Tree. And
had like 100 years to read it. I think it's all right if we.
Yeah, exactly. Oh yes, and Where the Woozle Wasn't is not only an excellent, just a marvelous phrase, by the way. Where the Woozle Wasn't is a fantastic, would be a fantastic title. But yes, that's like a spoiler of that entire chapter, in fact. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so...
So we're not even at the text yet.
We're not even at the text yet, but we'll keep going. Then we get a poetic dedication. I love the image. The image of is Pooh scratching his head, looking at a bath mat with the word "bath mat" on it, but he's looking at it, it's upside down, so that the word "bath mat" appears backwards. And so he's trying to figure out what Tam Hatab is, which is a very, of course, Morafok is the illustration, Tolkien gives that illustration, right? The word "coffee room" spelled backwards, which looks, you know, when you see it from the other side of the door, right, looks very strange and mysterious. Anyway, okay. And then we get an introduction. And in the introduction, what the introduction kind of does with the frame is interesting. If you happen to have read another book about Christopher Robin, you may remember that he once had a swan, or the swan had Christopher Robin, I don't know which, and that he used to call this swan Pooh. That was a long time ago, and when we said goodbye, we took the name with us, as we didn't think the swan would want it anymore. Well, when Edward Bear said that he would like an exciting name all to himself, Christopher Robin said at once, without stopping to think, that he was Winnie the Pooh. And he was. So as I have explained this Pooh part, I will now explain the rest of it. So he goes on, but just noticing the whole sort of like tone and frame, it has the same kind of immediacy as the map does, right? This is, the author is speaking, this goes well beyond even what, even like what Tolkien does. Some people may remember those moments in his famous essay, which of course was originally a lecture on fairy stories, in which he says things which suggest or sort of sound as if he believes that elves are real, right? Or at least he doesn't rule out the idea that elves are real and really exist. Well, A.A. Milne is writing the introduction absolutely from within the frame of the story, right? He's telling us about the story and how it came to be, but this is not the story of, like, how I came to make up stories about Winnie the Pooh. This is the story about how Edward Bear adopted the name, you know, was granted the name Winnie the Pooh by Christopher Robin, right? Anyway, so...
It almost changes the reception, doesn't it? Because it's not telling you a story about Pooh. It's bringing you into the story of Pooh.
Yes, let me introduce you to Pooh, right? Who was called Edward Bear, but then he was called Winnie the Pooh, and let me explain why he was, why he's called Winnie the Pooh. So, again, and this is especially interesting in the context, as I said, of those two frames, like the inside Christopher Robin's imagination frame and outside. Mm-hmm. Like, there is, officially, there is no outside, right? Christopher Robin's imagination is real, right? The book does not officially acknowledge that there is anything outside that frame. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really interesting move, right? Even though at the same time, again, the illustrations do clearly suggest what's happening here. But it never gets alluded to. So when we get to, again, I love the end, right? And now all the others are saying, what about us? So perhaps the best thing to do is to stop writing introductions and get on with the book, right? This is, there's no like authorial frame. There's no like, we're now going to enter the story. It's time to start imagining, you know, there are none of those kind of cues, which if you think about it are, I mean, that's what Once Upon a Time is, right? Is a framing mechanism to like,
slip you in.
Yeah. To trigger you to the fact, okay, so now we are using our imaginations, you know, imagining something that is removed from us at least in time, right? If not also in other important ways. You know, this is at the very least a galaxy far, far away, or maybe it's another world where the rules are entirely different, right? So like, that kind of frame prompts you in those sorts of ways. In that sense, this book is completely frameless. Right. It's totally. He just is operating from within that frame 100% of the time. The map, the introduction, everything. Then we get the picture of Christopher Robin dragging Pooh down the stairs. Right. Mm-hmm. And then we'll do the beginning of chapter one, in which we are introduced to Winnie the Pooh and some bees, and the stories begin. Here is Edward Bear, coming downstairs now, bump, 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 on the back of his head, behind Christopher Robin. It is, as far as he knows, the only way of coming downstairs, but sometimes he feels that there really is another way, if only he could stop bumping for a moment and think of it. And then he feels that perhaps there isn't. Anyway, here he is at the bottom, and ready to be introduced to you. Winnie the Pooh. When I first heard his name, I said, just as you are going to say, but I thought he was a boy. So did I, said Christopher Robin. Then you can't call him Winnie?
I don't.
But you said, he's Winnie the Pooh. Don't you know what there means?
Ah, yes, now I do, I said quickly, and I hope you do too, because it is all the explanation you are going to get. Sometimes Winnie the Pooh likes a game of some sort when he comes downstairs, and sometimes he likes to sit quietly in front of the fire and listen to a story. This evening, what about a story? Said Christopher Robin.
What about a story? I said.
Could you very sweetly tell Winnie the Pooh one?
I suppose I could, I said. What sort of story does he like?
About himself. He's that sort of bear.
Oh, I see.
So you could very sweetly?
I'll try, I said. So I tried.
Once upon a time, a very long time ago now, about last Friday...
We'll finish the sentence. Winnie the Pooh lived in a forest all by himself under the name of Sanders. Okay. One more paragraph. One more little bit.
Yeah.
Parentheses. What does under the name mean? Asked Christopher Robin. It means he had the name over the door in gold letters, and he lived under it. Winnie the Pooh wasn't quite sure, said Christopher Robin.
Now I am, said a growly voice.
Then I will go on, said I. Okay, so lots and lots of play with the narrator and the narrator's voice, right? Mm-hmm. This is, as you can see, an extremely self-conscious book. And by the way, I taught Winnie the Pooh in my Hobbit course, my Signum Hobbit course that I taught ages ago in the spring of 2022. No, summer. Summer of 2012 is when I taught it originally. And we did Winnie the Pooh as one of the sort of source texts, one of the to kind of understand a little bit better the kind of books that, you know, kids were reading those days when The Hobbit was released. And of course, the narrator's voice in The Hobbit, it's not exactly like the narrator's voice in Winnie the Pooh, but you can see some similarities. You can see some of the tendencies that Tolkien is kind of imitating. In the narrative voice of The Hobbit there.
It's very informal and familiar, isn't it? While still somehow, I don't know, it is still quite structured. You don't feel like you're just sitting around a campfire. It feels very friendly.
It does. And it's extremely meta, right? Like you're sitting there, often one is sitting there reading a story to a child, which chapter one of which is the story of an adult reading a story to a child. Like a child asks you to read them a story, and you read them a story about a child asking an adult to read them a story and him agreeing to read them a story. And then the story starts, you know, at the bottom of page two.
And then you get interrupted multiple times. But what does it mean to sit under that just as a child would?
Exactly. So it's a very... in that way, a very sort of in the moment kind of experience, right? It almost directs the child, right? Like when Christopher Robin interrupts to ask what under the name means, it's almost like it kind of gives a sort of permission to the child you're reading to. Like it's okay to interrupt to ask questions about words you don't understand. And almost as if to, expand upon that idea, he'll use a whole bunch of words that are either strange and unknown words or words that are misapplied or misspelled or something like that.
Yeah, I really like that it starts with that, like underneath the gold lettered sign. That's not the right answer, right? Like, I mean, the right answer would be that it says Winnie the Pooh in a perfect font because that's his home. But it's not, and we never get an explanation of that. So the fact that it doesn't make sense also is just really kind of like, oh, this is a bit different. And it sets that tone for us. We're going to have a few silly things that don't make any sense because it's a child's imagination.
And there's no question that that's a joke that the grown-ups are supposed to get, are supposed to find funny. Because grown-ups who read the book know full well that that's not what living under the name of Sanders means, right? That the name was written up there and he lived under it, right? So there's, it's known, right? We know that that's a joke, right? Christopher Robin doesn't know that it's a joke. But again, this is not just... Tolkien spoke once. Sorry, I keep bringing it back to Tolkien, but I can't help it.
Kind of what we do. Sorry.
Yeah, Tolkien spoke once about those children's books, which are often glancing at the adults in the room over the heads of the children and kind of laughing behind the backs of the children. And that moment feels almost close to that, right? Mm-hmm. Where, like, it's a joke almost sort of at the child's expense, right? That that is like between the adults. They'll get it, right? But the child doesn't get it. And part of the fact that the child believes that that's what living under the name means is almost part of the joke at the child's expense, right? But I don't think, in the end, I don't think that this, the thing that I think keeps that moment from being one of those moments that Tolkien was complaining about is the larger frame of the book, right? In fact, I think it's kind of turned around on us. We think we do know what living under the name, like what that phrase means, right? Yeah. I don't think he's giving the wrong answer to Christopher Robin. I think he's giving exactly the correct answer, and the joke is on us if we think it means something different. Yeah. So in the end, it's like one more, there's yet another level of that joke, right? Where we ourselves are, well, not disappointed, but we are surprised if we think we know what that means. The fact that within the, now that we've said Once Upon a Time, the interruptions by Christopher Robin and by the narrator are in parentheses here, right? And the fact that Winnie the Pooh himself speaks within that internal frame, right? Mm-hmm. Is, again, yet another sort of reminder that the frame outside and the frame inside, like that, you know, this is not just a, it's not like the normal fantasy world thing, right? Where you have the primary world, like you start off in the normal world and then you imaginatively enter the magical world of the story, right? And then when you stop reading or whatever, you know, and sometimes there might be reminders of it. Sometimes that frame might intrude itself. Again, as the Hobbit narrator does occasionally intrude himself within that frame. But there's still like things still pretty much stay inside the frame. This book doesn't stay inside the frame.
Yeah. But I would say the films do. Now that I'm thinking through it, because we don't really have the same flexibility and freedom to interject with a film as we do with this text.
Yes.
And they build it in. And when you build it into a film, sometimes it just feels a bit twee. I don't know if that translates. It feels a bit forced. It feels a bit saccharine.
Yes.
When it's reading it in the coziness of your bedroom, you know, maybe with a parent reading it to you, there's a certain conversationality that's really inviting about that. Whereas in a film, I don't know if it would read as well. It'd be a lot harder to convey that same vibe. So in terms of adaptation, that would be really tricky to nail that feeling.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's one of the challenges. Narrator's voice at all is really hard to do in a film. I mean, it's... Yeah. There have been films that have pulled it off well. Yeah, like a consistent recurrent voiceover narrator, you know, narrator's voice, that kind of frames the narrative of a film in the way that a narrator's voice can frame a story in a book. Mm-hmm. But it's very unusual. I'm trying to think now. I'm challenging myself to try to think of an example. I'm trying to think of an example of a good one. Like one that does it well. And I can't come up with any off the top of my head.
I can't at the moment, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means that maybe it was so smooth that it didn't.
But I do think it's unusual.
Yeah.
I do think
it's unusual. Usually like voiceover you just hear of being either a frame narrative or a crutch, right? And if it's a frame, it's purely there to give you a bookend. It doesn't do anything else. If it's a crutch, then it's not used appropriately and it's giving something that could have been done a different way and shown and not told.
Yeah.
Finding that voice that's able to walk the line and have that conversation. And Love Actually is the one that keeps coming, not Love Actually, The Holiday. But that's like a radio voiceover and that's like a separate character and it's not an internal dialogue. I don't know. That one doesn't do it for me.
I don't know Dogville, so I can't comment on that. The Princess Bride, of course, is a fascinating example, but there's more to it there than just a voiceover narrator.
And the text Princess Bride narrator is very different than the film.
Very, very. That itself is a fascinating illustration of that even when you do a similar kind of framing mechanism in a film that you do in a book, it's still quite different. When he does
done that. Princess Bride yet? At all? On Other Minds and Hands?
I don't know. Did we? I can't remember. I know I did a whole Mythgard Academy thing on it.
File that away.
Yeah. Certainly.
It's one of my faves.
Yeah, me too. And it's an extremely fascinating example because of the history of its of both the writing of the book and of the making of the screenplay. In the best possible way, I think that The Princess Bride is a bad data point when it comes to adaptation.
Oh, but it's a fantastic, like, lecture point, you know?
Yeah.
Data point, tough. But in terms of, like, an artifact to discuss, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Back to narrative voice.
Back to narrative voice. Okay. Anyway, the point is, that is a thing that is really, really hard to do on film. It's just not a mechanism that lends itself really well. But people try. I think in large part because of the idea that a narrator's voice and the interaction between the narrator of a story and the story itself, like to be able to go back and forth between those two different levels, where you have, you know, the two different stories happening at the same time, both the story itself and then the story of the narration, right? The narrator's perspective, like the story of the narrator's perspective. Anyway, it's such a sort of a natural thing to try to do.
Mm-hmm.
You can see why some films would attempt it, but it's not a normal thing. Okay. Other things, again, there's so much about the framing that I find so striking here. Notice even how the beginning of the book, the whole first paragraph, is like a live action commentary of the picture.
Yeah. The thing I was trying to think about was just how this is so different and why this is so different. Because I think when you just experience it, and most of us read this when we were little, it's been around forever. I don't think I had the wherewithal to think about this as setting up something differently. Mm-hmm. But if someone was going to tell this story, 99% of the time it would have come out with, once there was a boy named Christopher Robin.
Yeah.
He had a teddy bear. Yes. You know, it would be this point for point, and that is not at all what we're being dealt here.
Mm-hmm.
So just that separation, I feel like, is really interesting and so unique to the text.
Yes. Yeah. It's all of the things that the narrator takes for granted that make it so jarring in a really fun way, right? You get kind of startled into engagement with this story. Mm-hmm. Right. So now let's think about the openings of the films. Because on the one hand, both of the two films, both the 77 animated version, the classic Disney Winnie the Pooh animation, and the 2018 Christopher Robin live action film with the amazing cast, is both of them attempt to ground themselves very explicitly in the book. Right? They both start off with
really similar starts.
Very similar beginnings. I mean, in fact, that was one thing, a little footnote that I wanted to make on the Christopher Robin film, is that I'm not even sure it's fair to say that it's primarily an adaptation of the book. I think it's primarily an adaptation of the 1977 film.
Yeah. Which, I think most of the things that have come in terms of adaptation are on the 1977 film.
Mm-hmm.
And I know quite a few people that really hate the 1977 because it's so different from the text and really can't forgive Disney for what they did to Winnie the Pooh. And, mm-hmm. you know, the same thing we're talking about with adaptation, just having it be a very personal affront to their heart.
Mm-hmm.
Disney changed it. But yeah, I think most of it is kind of the 1977 onwards.
Yes. Yes. The things that struck me most, first and foremost, were the voices. I mean, they work really hard to make Pooh and Tigger and Piglet and everybody sound exactly like the voices from the 1977 film.
Yeah.
So that, and then including, you know, quotations and they, like the Tigger song, and, you know, there are bunches of things that they do, which are very clear movie references, but not book references about the stuff. However, Mrs. Manrique, I agree, by the way, like they did a phenomenal job. Like the voice actors do an amazing job of imitating the original voice cast of the 1977 film. It's really very effective. But one thing that's real, go ahead.
And with that, I think there's a real important continuity. If your baseline of understanding Winnie the Pooh is the 1977 version, and then you throw a spanner in the works with a totally different voice. Like, originally, wasn't it the 2018 film, originally Tigger was going to be that Irish actor?
Oh, I don't remember. I
remember. It tested horribly, and people were like, no.
That's not Tigger.
And they recast it to a guy that played Tigger in a video game or something.
Right.
So it was already a familiar voice that sounded the same, because, yeah, you don't mess with expectation unless there's a real good reason to do that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that they did mess with from a 1977 film perspective, and this, again, this is what I thought was so interesting about the kind of the how they were situating the characters in the story. On the one hand, the voices were, again, they were clearly attempting to be straight out of 1977, and many of the sayings and stuff, but visually they're straight out of the illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Winnie the Pooh, the teddy bear Winnie the Pooh in the 2018 version looks like the pictures of Winnie the Pooh, not like the Disney version in 1977.
Same with
Tigger, same with Kanga and Roo, same, all of them, right? All of them look like
the classic.
The actual illustrations from the book. So the visuals are from the book. The audio and a lot of the lines and things are from the 1977 adaptation. It was really that combination I found really fascinating. I felt like it was like, once again, I was having the kind of cognitive dissonance in a sense, a different sort, right? But where I was like, I'm like, what frame am I in here? You know, what are we sort of connecting back?
I wonder if that's all. I mean, I would love to hear the conversation of how they kind of came through that, because I wonder if that's all just managing expectation of the visuals that people have burned into their brains are those beautiful illustrations. And I mean, I remember in high school, it became like Gund, you know, the teddy bear company came out with a classic Pooh line.
Yes.
And that's still what you can buy in the shops. Yes, you can still get the Disneyfied versions, but the classic Pooh stuff was so trendy and so popular that having that alongside the expected sounds of the text, it's a win-win.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So that was interesting. Now, both of the films play with, so as I want to focus for a second on the frames, because this is to me the thing that is so striking about the Winnie the Pooh book. I mean, there's so much that is brilliant and delightful and charming and funny about the Winnie the Pooh book. You know, my kids and I are still always, in my wife, we still always allude to Winnie the Pooh. you know, I to this day, like we were on vacation last week and like we can't stop to buy food without like making a joke about buying provisions, you know, for the expedition. Like it's guaranteed somebody's going to refer to that, you know, whenever yeah. we do, whenever we do that. So, I mean, it's, but the thing that I find, so, fascinating is the frame, right? And again, when thinking about the opening, the thing that is so striking about the opening of Winnie the Pooh, the whole opening thing, right, is the way that it brings you in and the way in which it's playing with the frame, with the story frame. You know, it's like there are three different frames. There's like the real world that you and I live in and the author of the book lives in. And then there's the world of Christopher Robin. There's the world of the stories that we're going to read, like the story in which Pooh finds some bees and the story begins right here in chapter one. But then there's the story of the narrator sitting down and telling a story to Christopher Robin and Pooh, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a whole separate layer of story that's happening at the same time. And so you've got these three things all kind of interacting with each other. In the openings, what do you feel are the effect? Because I thought it was a strikingly different effect. They were clearly trying to invoke this kind of meta frame, right? Mm. With the both of the films feature bookshelves with Winnie the Pooh, with the Winnie the Pooh books sitting on the shelf, right? Which is kind of meta, right? As well as seeing like Christopher Robin's play, you know, his room with his stuffed animals and stuff, right? Again, both of those things, are I don't know. I'm not sure what to think about it. As I said, I can see what they're trying to do, but I think it has a quite different effect than the book is creating.
Yeah, it feels a bit twee to me. I'm using that word again because it just feels like it's trying a little hard to be like, oh, Winnie the Pooh,
right.
You know, this thing from your childhood. And
yes, the world of a child's imagination.
The 1977 one, it really opens with that like Disney kind of, and look, here's our friends Roo and Kanga having a picnic. And it just, it feels like a sports commentary at sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's a useful tool to show us a child's bedroom and to show us toys. And we can certainly see the pull of the desire of imagination on children's toys from our own childhood. I mean, look at Toy Story. We have four films and potentially a fifth coming out about toys coming to life and the rich lives that they lead when our backs are turned. So it's not beyond any kind of comprehension to have this world that would exist. So
yes.
Showing us something very familiar and then introducing something quite fantastic. Great. I get it. But I feel like tonally, it's quite different for Winnie the Pooh. So I wonder if that's another separation of adaptation versus text. The 77 and the 2018 are playing off each other more than they're playing off the original.
Yes, I think that was certainly the case. I mean, although, again, you can see how, and this is not the first time we've seen a book adaptation whose opening image is a book, right? Like the Rankin Bass Hobbit, right? Doing the same thing. Like you open, you know, the opening shot is a book opening and pages turning. And then, you know, the beginning of the first chapter with the first lines of voiceover dialogue written on them. Right. And so like that kind of like, oh, this is a movie, but it's a movie in which we're entering into the book. Right. It's not an uncommon move, especially for adaptations of children's stories. And yet I felt that it went I think that it goes in the opposite direction that the book goes in, right? By panning around Christopher Robin's room and showing us his inert stuffed animals, right? And then shifting into animation and showing us them coming, you know, living their little lives in the 100-acre wood. I think it has the opposite effect that the book has. The book proceeds from the beginning, from the introduction, before the story has even begun. Within the introduction, it is operating under the premise that Winnie the Pooh is animate. You know, that Edward Bear, soon to be called Winnie the Pooh, is
a really living, breathing.
Yeah. I mean, that he's just there. He's a character. Whereas, again, the pan around Christopher Robin's room has the effect of saying, these are a child's toys. What you're going to see is only imagination.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
It's not real because this is reality. The reality is these inert stuffed animals. That's the reality. But now let us enter into the magic of childhood imagination.
And that's what we were saying with like the introduction. If any other story had told us, it would have said, here's a boy named Christopher Robin and here are his toys.
Yeah.
That's not what the text does. The text gives us this really actual happening real life thing to the point that you didn't even know it was a teddy bear for a really long time. Like,
yeah.
It's a very different way than Disney chose to frame it.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's in your head. Why would it not be real?
Exactly. But it's so yes, now, I will admit, the 1977 film does a good bit to, at the very least, I think they're trying to preserve the spirit of playfulness that the frame of the story has. By the way that they, like, how sometimes the characters in the movie will get themselves out of the problems that they have. You know, like, I love that wonderful line in the 77 film when Tigger says, oh, it's the narrator, right?
Yes.
Like, I always love that line.
That's handy.
And when Pooh is like jumping across the
letters.
You know, the book, you know, from one page of the book to the next page of the book, the self-consciousness, like the fact that Winnie the Pooh and the other characters are aware of the fact that they are characters in a book that's being read, is kind of, it's a similar sort of play with framing levels. But it isn't the same level. Again, if anything, it actually, I think, goes in the opposite direction. Right? It's like they know that they're fictional characters in a story, and they're having fun with the fact that they are fictional characters in a story whose problems can be solved by the narrator, right? Mm-hmm. They can't solve their problems themselves, but the narrator can get them out of it, right, if he helps them. But again, that I think is the opposite of what the book is doing. The book is suggesting none of it is fictional. It's all true. It's all true, right?
Because the book isn't based on a book.
Right.
You know, the adaptations are really trying to show that they are based on a solid text.
Yes.
The book is its own pre-existing thing. The film's trying to honor, but they do that by actively bringing letters into the visuals for Winnie to jump from bit to bit on.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting effect that by trying to retain its connection to the original book, it actually, again, goes in a completely opposite direction from the original book. If instead of playing in that way, I don't know. Like, I think they could have made different choices and ended up being in its way more like the book. Because at the end of the day, the fundamental premise of the framing mechanisms and the frame play of the book and the film, thinking of the 1977 one, are totally different, right? The fundamental framing message of the 77 film is that though all of this is delightful and fun, all of this is imagination, right? And you can put that in positive. I'm not saying it's horrible. Like, you put that in positive, like, look how, like, the imagination in the book comes to life. You know, just as Christopher Robin, through his imagination, made his stuffed animals come to life, so can you, through your imagination, imagine the characters in a book or in a movie coming to life, right? And isn't that all very delightful? Yes, sure. But it still places this uncrossable gulf, ultimately, between the real world and, you know, the fantasy world. The gulf which Winnie the Pooh, the book, doesn't even acknowledge exists, right? There is no gap. Everything is Marvel. Everything is fantasy. You know, Edward Bear is as much a, you know, a person and a character, you know, than anybody else. Now, the 2018 film.
I'm gonna say, I'm like, we've got a
did fascinating play with that then. As well, right?
If you haven't seen the 2018, just to give you a tiny bit of background, this is like Christopher Robin as a grown-up forgetting what it is to have a childhood and that imagination. He's, you know, a super Mr. Banks type businessman that has no joy in his life anymore and trying to remember the Christopher Robin of his childhood. So, but it opens with one of the sweetest depictions of childhood toys. They're having a farewell party for him.
As he goes off to boarding school,
Yeah, I didn't get teary, but it was that kind of feeling of just like his best friends were saying goodbye to him as he was about to go to boarding school as like, what, a 10-year-old? I mean, he was small.
Mm-hmm.
So there was just this real feeling that I thought that film encapsulated really well of like the farewell to childhood. And
yes.
The mourning and grief that your animals, that your stuffed animals feel when you don't feel for them anymore and you're not present anymore. And, ooh, it tugged real hard at those heartstrings right off the bat.
Yes, yes. And the intrusion of of grief and the real world, which supersedes the, you know, the joy of his childhood, right? From his father dies while he's at boarding school, right? So the whole, you're the man of the house now, you know, speech that he gets there when he's like 11 or whatever,
right.
When his father dies. And then of course he goes off to World War II, right? He's off in war and, experiencing horrible things. Anyway, so it's
heavy.
There's a lot there.
Yeah, it's not the same levity that we have from, but it's, that's kind of the point. And it's also the director of Finding Neverland. So it's like kind of taking, blanking on his name, but it's Mark something. It's taking that same kind of, I don't know, it felt like the same kind of appreciation and honoring of children's literature, but taking it to that next level and showing kind of the depth and the darkness that can sometimes come from creating these fantastical stories. And I can't wait to finish it. The first part.
I have to admit, I love this film. I thought it was really fascinating. So, so notice that from the beginning, the whole premise of the film is about the relationship between the real world and the fantasy world, right? It's entirely kind of like diving into that divide and following Christopher Robin out of the world of his childhood imagination and into the real world where we live, right? And so it's kind of, it takes the play with the frame back into the kind of re-examining the kinds of boundaries that the book was, which again, I think the 1977 film really didn't do. Especially since they make clear boundaries, right? There are doors in trees that you have to go through. Like the Hundred Acre Woods isn't just something you find yourself in when you imagine it, right? Like you've got to get down on your hands and knees and crawl through a door in a tree to get there. And of course, the other thing that was, and I have to admit, I was not at all sure how they were going to handle this. So like there were lots of with the way the film was coming out, I fully expected Winnie the Pooh to come out into the real world. And I didn't, just seeing it, I mean, I just saw it for the first time. I did not see this film before. So this was new for me when I was watching it. And I'd forgotten any trailers or anything, so I didn't really have any idea what happened. I fully expected Winnie the Pooh to come out into the real world. What I was less sure of was whether he would be visible to other people.
Other people.
Right? The question, that the setup that they did about, you know, Christopher Robin's wife anticipating that he was going to have some kind of psychotic break, right? You know, that he was going to crack under the stress and pressure he was under, led me to wonder if that's what they were setting up, if they were going to be setting up a, you know, he can see Winnie the Pooh, but nobody else can see Winnie the Pooh, because Winnie the Pooh is just a figure of his own imagination, and this is his own childhood imagination, you know, returning and trying to rescue him from his, you know, current, like, horrible life, basically. I thought there was a chance that that's where the film was going to go, but the film does not go there at all. And instead, like, the whole premise is everybody can see Winnie the Pooh moving and talking, and he, and then later, you know, Tigger and Piglet and Eeyore also, you know, have to try to act like normal stuffed animals so that nobody, you know, sees them and they don't freak people out, which of course they're always doing. Anyway, it was, so they do in fact have the fantasy world. They give an objectivity to the fantasy world, which it seems to have in the book, right? Which the book seems to invite us to imagine, that Edward Bear is as much of a real character as Christopher Robin himself, right? And anyway, the film, I was surprised when the film went in that direction and was really interested to see that. But at the same time, they kept the boundaries. Like, you still have to enter. You still have to get down on your hands and knees and crawl into the Hundred Acre Wood. And he does that, and he brings his family with him at the end, which is lovely, and it's fun. Sorry, spoilers, Maggie. I know spoilers. You didn't get to the end. But
what, you mean it has a happy ending? Stop.
But I suppose you're not going to be shocked to find that that happens at the end.
I would be real peeved if it didn't have a happy ending.
Yes.
That is not what we sign up for Ewan McGregor, Hayley Atwell, Winnie the Pooh story.
Yes, yes. But anyway, like, they enter in, so it's objective in the sense that it's not just his imagination, right? Other people can crawl through that tree and see it also, right? He can bring, you know, the stuffed animals can come to the board meeting, you know, at his work, and you know, the owner of the company can see them and interact with them in the same way, right? So they're objective in this sense, and yet there's still a boundary. Like, it still is, like, that the world of the Hundred Acre Woods, though it has objective reality, is still also objectively separated from our world. It was a fascinating kind of having it both ways that they seem to be doing in that film.
Who, do you remember who wrote it?
No.
Alex Ross Perry. Oh, no, they've got, just curious if they had any kind of background in adaptation or something like this, but no, they're all television. Listen Up, Philip, Her Smell, those are indies. Good Night, Good Luck, Meet the Parents, Boston Public, Law and Order is one of the writers. And the last one is Hidden Figures. So yeah, very, very different background than what I would have thought. Cause I'm like, oh, maybe this was their creative way to interpret this. And, but no, I don't know.
Yeah. That's, so Sharon has an interesting question. Is there anything in the fact that the 1977 film is a compilation of several shorts that had been available for almost 10 years, whereas the Christopher Robin film was an original story never seen before? Well, it's certainly, it contributes to the fact that, and of course, this is one way in which the 77 film is much more like the book. The book doesn't have a plot, right? I mean, it's a series of episodes of stuff that happens in the Hundred Acre Woods, right? So there's no overarching narrative of Winnie the Pooh. Whereas, of course, the Christopher Robin film very much, you know, had a plot and a shape to it. It was telling a very particular story. And so genre-wise, the film was setting out to tell a very different kind of story. Whereas, you know, and Sharon, what would be really interesting to me is to wonder, what would the 1977 film have been like if they had approached it as a feature film from the beginning, right? Would they have tried? Is the only thing that kept the Winnie the Pooh film as episodic as it was the fact that it was a compilation in that way? Would they have tried to shape it into an overall narrative prior to, you know, or if they hadn't had that? I kind of suspect that they might have done, as most of the, you know, the Disney animated features, I mean, that kind of episodic flavor that the Winnie the Pooh film has is unusual for the.
And they did afterwards. Films. They didn't carry on with episodic Winnie the Poohs. They came out with quite a few. I think there's six different versions of, mm-hmm. of full length features, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they started with something that was familiar and then grew it into it. But I also think that's why it's interesting to talk about these two. Like, we could have picked other versions of Winnie the Pooh to talk about, but the 77 is kind of the quintessential, and 2018 is totally different.
Yes.
So, yeah, we are taking a totally different approach to the same content, like to the same core material, mm-hmm. and just seeing how people manipulate that story in a different way. So, yeah, not a direct comparison, just really interesting to look at the two different ways that this is told.
Yeah.
And then I feel like we have to at least acknowledge the comment earlier about Winnie the Pooh and honey and what's it called?
Blood and Honey.
Blood and Honey.
Yeah.
Lordy. So, yeah. So Winnie the Pooh went out of copyright in 2022. So now it's in the public domain so people can do what they want with it. And that's a horror film is what came out of it. No, I have not watched it. No, I will not watch it. I don't want to.
I haven't watched it either. I didn't. I'm not going to lie. I didn't know it existed. I would look something up because I wanted to find a particular scene and I was too lazy to scrub. So I just looked for it on YouTube from the 1977 film. And when I typed Winnie the Pooh into the YouTube thing, Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey came up on the, and I was like, what? I don't think I want to know what that is.
Yeah, my husband and I are like kind of obsessed with watching trailers. So like two or three times a week, we'll just sit down and watch whatever new trailers are out on YouTube. And that one came up a couple years ago and we were like, what? Hard pass.
Yeah. No, I have not seen it.
Moving on. So back to our 2018 wonderful.
Back to the 2018 one. Yeah. Anyway, so I by the way, of course, it also didn't escape me that this is now kind of a little motif that we've been doing, right? The Christopher Robin film and the Alice in Wonderland film, right? Are both this very similar kind of reimaginings, right? Both of them are like sort of sequels when the main character grows up, right? Alice is grown up and turned 19 and returns to Wonderland, and Christopher Robin has grown up and returns to the Hundred Acre Wood as an adult. And of course they're not doing exactly the same thing, but that was an interesting, having just talked about Alice in Wonderland last time, the last two times, I was struck by some of the similarity of that, that both of the times there, and the trend, I don't know if there is a causal relationship here, but when the films were shifting from cartoon to live action, both of them chose a later adult frame for the story, which I think is an interesting kind of correlation. I don't know how much causality is involved there, but it was an interesting correlation.
Yeah, and somebody just mentioned George Fire, just mentioned Hook.
Hook, oh my god. Yes.
And we were talking about that. Like, clearly we have to do Peter Pan at some point. And yes. I was like, oh, we have to talk about Hook because I think that's one of the best. But yeah, I mean, you can also see a similar theme there of that whole question of childhood and what is childhood and how does that differ to what you become as a grown up. Well, the best way to show that is to have your character grow up and look back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, the other thing that all three of those, so if we include Hook right there, they're not just children's books. They're old children's books.
Yes.
Right. They're children's books that, like, no matter who is in your audience, everyone in your audience will have grown up reading. Like, you know, there's the generation of people who were adults when these books were published are dead now. Right? Like, no, with no question. We're talking like the 20s and 30s and such, yeah. when these, or sooner. Peter Pan was sooner. This was 20s. When the Pooh was in the 20s, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. I'm not remembering the exact dates. But anyway, it was the first quarter of the 20th century when all of them, you know, when it was early when Peter Pan, Winnie the Pooh, and Alice in Wonderland was 19th century, right? So, I mean, we're talking, you know, so all of these are old children's books. And so everyone in the audience will have had the experience, except the children in the audience, every adult in the audience will have had the experience of discovering this book as a child and then coming back to it as an adult. And right. So some kind of a sort of appeal to that, thinking about because there are ways in which both of the films are interested in the question of like the relevance of the children's story to the adult world, right? Mm-hmm. I do think that's a central interest of both of those films, not in the same way, but it's definitely an interest. Mm. And I think it's been a few years since I've seen Hook. I'll have to rewatch it before we talk about it, of course. But that one too, as I recall.
Let's put a pin in that one because I feel like that should tie in quite well with what we're doing now. But we do need to talk about Dune for a couple weeks, totally. And then maybe we'll circle back to Peter Pan because there's some lovely adaptations of that. I'd also like to talk about, I don't know, we haven't done a lot of stage shows, but the stage musical of Peter Pan was just as iconic as the Disney cartoon to me as a kid.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I didn't see it. So it was not so in my experience, but I know that has been, that is high up on my list of ones that like stories for which the stage adaptation is at least as important and influential.
Just the music,
in the history of the story, yeah.
And Phil, 100% the 2003 Peter Pan with Jason Isaacs. The music from that, James Newton Howard, like that was one of the first scores that haunted my dreams in a most wonderful way. There are some really wonderful adaptations, and there's a few really questionable adaptations, like the most recent Pan, and there was another one a couple years ago that Wendy and Peter and Wendy,
mm-hmm.
something like that. But yeah, there's a lot out there. Mm-hmm. I think we could talk about, but
yeah. So I agree. We'll come back and we'll do, we had mentioned doing Peter Pan. There's a lot of Peter Pan. We can come back and definitely spend a session or two on Peter Pan. But first, we've got to talk about Dune, because
we've got to talk about Dune.
A phenomenal adaptation has just been released, and it's such a fascinating illustration of so many of the things that we've discussed.
I haven't talked about it with anyone yet, so I feel like there's like a catharsis that has to happen in addition to analysis.
Yes.
And it's been a really long time since I've read the text, so like I've kind of purposely put a little distance. So I might focus more heavily on just the cinematic mm-hmm. impress of mm-hmm. it, because my God, I haven't seen a film like this in so long.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've decided already I'm going to do an experiment based on things that we've talked about before. So I love Dune by Frank Herbert. I've loved it since I was in high school, but I'm not a huge Frank Herbert fan. Like, I really like Dune. But I never loved the series. Like, I've read Dune Messiah, and I don't even remember honestly if I finished Children of Dune, and I haven't read anything else. So like I know Dune really well, but I don't know the sequels at all. I've read Dune Messiah like once or twice. I've read the Children of Dune like 0.5 times. So, and I suspect they're going to go on and do more of the Dune story in films. And so I've decided I'm not going to reread the sequels until after I've seen, if there are more films, I'm going to wait until after the films.
Welcome to my world.
That's it. So like I was all focused on the, and I was not just focused on the book, but I was thinking about the book all the time, before and after seeing the second film. And my first impulse was to be like, if there's going to be more, like, I'm going to go and I'm going to read all six of the Dune books, you know, and I'm going to, Frank Herbert's Dune books. I'm going to go and do that. And to get myself ready for, in case there are future films. And I was like, wait, no, I'm going to wait now from here. I'm going to wait until all the films are done. And then I'll reread the books after all the films are done. That's what I decided I'm going to do.
And I mean, we've obviously discussed this before. There's give and takes to both of these people. I can hear everybody screaming at me. And like, I know I've got friends who make their kids read the book before they're allowed to see the movie. And I just won't do it anymore unless it's a thing I'm actively studying or working on. You tend to enjoy the film for what it is. And then you get more when you read the book. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'm looking for... My memory is... The last time I read Dune Messiah was ages ago. So I barely remember it, so I'll be almost fresh if you know, with whatever comes next. And then after that I would be, and I'm there were several things. It was in particular the vision of Aaliyah as an adult, and that Aaliyah the sister as an adult was cast with, what's, I forget her name, the woman who was the star of the Queen's Gambit,
forgotten. For the love, Anna Joy, something. Somebody's gonna get it. It'll come up in the chat in a moment, right?
Anyway, I can't remember her name, but the fact that like they cast her as Aaliyah and showed her in the film for exactly like 3 seconds,
right?
I was like, okay, so.
And didn't put her in the credits.
And didn't put her in the,
I stayed and watched that and was like, oh, yeah.
I'm like, okay, so they're clearly planning to make future films. And Aaliyah is going to be really important. Anya Taylor-Joy?
Anya Taylor-Joy. Yeah. I needed that.
Yeah, thanks. There we go. Thank you, Edith. Anyway, anyway, so I'm feeling pretty confident that they're going to keep going with the Dune saga. And so I'm like, okay, I'm ready. I'm going to save myself.
And I feel like in terms of adaptation, we're going to need like a series to talk. I could do a whole lecture on just the sound and then you got costumes and then somebody also mentioned Narnia. Of course we have to do Narnia. That's another biggie though, isn't it? Like, we haven't touched Harry Potter. We haven't touched Narnia. We haven't touched some of these things that we know really well.
Yeah.
But also with Greta Gerwig's adaptation coming out, I'm kind of keen to just hang on to that until we know a bit more from Netflix.
But we
watched Greta Gerwig's The Little Women.
That was a suggestion that we got, that since Greta Gerwig is doing, she's doing Narnia, right?
Narnia, and she just did Barbie.
Yeah. That therefore we should look at the Greta Gerwig Little Women as a kind of a warm to sort of like see how Greta Gerwig does adaptate direct book adaptation like that, right?
Yeah. Differently is the answer, and that's always really interesting to discuss. But yeah. Love all the Little Women's just because I like spending time in that world, but I did enjoy this one quite a bit.
Yeah.
We have a lot. In short, so we'll be on for a few more years.
Exactly. And this is all still before this stuff even comes out. That is the Narnia thing and Rings of Power season 2 and lots of things happening. So anyway, but for next time, Dune. We'll talk about Dune 2 next week for at least 1 week, and it will probably take us 2, I think. But yeah, we'll have some discussion of Dune 2 next time. So if you haven't seen it yet, absolutely go see it. See it in the theater if you can. you know, I know it bothers some people, but I'd love, like, you know, you see it in a theater where, like, your body cavities can resonate with the sound. Oh, man, yeah. Like, so good. So I love it. I
splurged and drove the extra 20 minutes to go to an IMAX because this is the kind of film you want to watch in an IMAX if you can. I'm tempted to do the 4DX where you get, you know, the vibrations and the breaths of air and stuff purely for the sound mixing. Like, yes. I would be tempted to give it a whirl. So
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'll do that again this week before we talk next week.
Yeah, I have I tend to have motion sickness issues with IMAX, but I'd be willing to give it a whirl just to see how it would go.
Just get an aisle seat so you can sit on the step if you need to.
Yeah, but even just sitting in a theater with the you know the Dolby Atmos sound, and it was awesome. It was awesome. All right, thanks everybody. More discussion of Dune next gushing. Week. You have we're your gushing. Assignment. Go see it if you haven't. It is amazing. And we will discuss some of the things. Both some things. And there are some things I didn't like about it. There are things that I thought didn't work very well. Or on other things that I was just curious about and have interesting questions about. But anyway, we'll see. Lots to talk about. So we'll see you guys next week. Thanks very much, everybody. Bye now.
See ya.